ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
This year, a record number of women began serving in the U.S. Congress. That milestone comes in the same year that we celebrate the 100th anniversary of American women getting the right to vote. On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to look at that long, circuitous route that women have traveled to become full participants in our democratic process. It's been a journey filled with some fascinating stories, including the role that Wisconsin has played. Our guest today is Carolyn Eichner, Associate Professor of History and Women's and Gender Studies in UWM's College of Letters and Science. Welcome, Carolyn. Good to have you on today's program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You know, I'm thinking about perhaps some of your students at UWM, young Gen Zers or millennials even, who walk into the classroom and walk into the community and think, well, women are at the same status as men. Wasn't it always that way? It clearly was not.
That's very true. And I think it still isn't true, but this has a long history. In the United States, the women's suffrage movement began in 1848. And it grew out of the abolition movement, the movement to end slavery. Women were involved in the abolition movement, but in ways that weren't fully integrated. And a great example is Lucretia Mott, who was a woman suffragist ultimately. She was an abolitionist. She traveled to London on her honeymoon, actually, and with her husband, who was also an abolitionist, to attend the World Anti-Slavery Convention. And there, she and all the other women were made to sit behind a curtain. So they weren't allowed to participate. They weren't allowed to be seen. And when she got home, she really had thought about the fact that I think that women also need a movement for emancipation.
And this is way back. This is 1840. So we're talking over 150 years.
Yes. And it took about 8 years. And she, along with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who may be names that listeners are familiar with, they organized the first women's rights convention. And they were even a little hesitant as to whether or not to include the vote because it was seen as kind of presumptuous. And after much debate and discussion and with encouragement of Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist newspaper publisher, they decided to include the call for the vote in the Declaration of Sentiments, which is what came out of the Seneca Falls Convention.
And again, that was back well before we saw a resolution to the question or issue of slavery here in the U.S. So there were these two companion struggles going on at the same time.
Right, and that it resulted in some conflict. At the end of the Civil War, when there were constitutional amendments put forth for black men to get the vote, some of the women suffragists, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, were opposed to supporting the vote only for black men. They felt that it was that women had been struggling, it was also their turn. And this really split the suffrage movement. They did not support black men getting the vote without white women also getting the vote. So this split the women's suffrage movement for about the next 20 years. And then it came back together again, and then it split again at the beginning of about the beginning of the 20th century, and that was a split based on tactics. One was a more conservative approach. One was a more radical approach, which included protesting the White House, women chaining themselves to the fence of the White House.
I read about those protests at the White House. This is, again, in the early 1900s, mm-hmm. right? And it was violent. Mm-hmm. There were women who were severely injured in those protests.
Right. Well, what had happened was when the leader of the radical faction, Alice Paul, had been in London studying to get her PhD. She's the first American woman to get a PhD in political science. And in London, she saw the really radical tactics that the suffragettes, the British suffragettes, and that's how they were calling themselves, were taking, and they included bombing things, and it was very violent. But what she took away from that was some kind of radical action was necessary. She came back to the U.S. and influenced a lot of women to really take physical presence. So they marched in the streets, they picketed the White House day after day, they were arrested. And once they were arrested, many of them went on hunger strike. And this was a very violent situation where many women were force-fed by having tubes shoved down their noses and into their stomachs. And there was a lot most of these women were middle and upper class women, white women, who were accustomed to expecting a certain degree of privilege from the authorities. And the fact that they were treated this way actually advanced their cause, because a lot of Americans were shocked by this.
Where were their husbands? Where were other men in this process?
Well, there were men who supported the suffrage movement, and there were men who opposed the suffrage movement. And, you know, these were women who they had their own voices and their own politics, and they were tired of being marginalized. And, you know, as I said, they're white, mostly middle and upper class women who were accustomed to a certain degree of privilege, and they were trying to really exercise it, and the state was not happy.
What about the average woman who might not have had that status, might not have had the privilege of perhaps even having time to get away from work to go and protest? Were they well informed of what was at stake here?
Well, the women's suffrage movement was not the only women's movement in the 19th century. There were other feminist movements, because to be able to fight for the vote, to be able to even think about the vote. The vote is something that's abstract. The vote doesn't feed your children or clothe your children. It doesn't put a roof over your head. So there were women who had much more economic concerns. So there were a lot of socialist feminists. There were anarchist feminists. There were feminists who really thought that the vote was fine for people who didn't have to worry about being able to earn a living wage and to be able to survive in the world. And that was the case in the United States in the 19th century and in Europe also.
Let's talk a little bit about how America has compared to other countries in terms of giving women the right to vote. And in a moment, we're going to talk about some of the other rights that perhaps still have not been attained. Were we ahead of the pack, or were there other countries that were doing better than the U.S.?
We were not ahead of the pack. In terms of the vote, ultimately, women finally get the vote in the United States. You know, 1920, it finally passes. But before the United States, New Zealand was the first country, and then the list is very long of countries that got that – where women got the vote, which, you know, include Scandinavian countries, Afghanistan, et cetera. But in terms of the women's suffrage struggle, as I mentioned before, the British struggle was more radical, and it was actually much larger and more visible. But women in England – all women didn't get the vote until 1928. Women over 30 with property got it in 1918. In France, the women's suffrage movement was actually quite small, because there were many leftist, socialist, feminist movements that were concerned with the things I was talking about before, with economics, with work, with marriage rights, other legal concerns that they felt that wouldn't be addressed by the vote. So, and ultimately, in France, women didn't get the vote until 1944, not until after World War II.
So, but the big turning point here in the U.S. came after Congress finally ratified the constitutional amendment, but then it had to go to all the different states.
Right, it had to go to
for ratification.
Exactly, 36 states had to pass it. So, some states had already women had already gotten the vote in some states on the state level. Wyoming being the first. Wyoming, it wasn't that Wyoming was particularly progressive. It was that they wanted statehood and they needed more bodies. And so that by giving women the vote, which meant giving them full citizenship, then they would have a sufficient number of citizens. But the way that the amendment was passed, and then it had to go to 36 states, well, Wisconsin was the first to ratify it, and then Tennessee was the final one.
And the ratification by the state of Wisconsin came – it was in 1919, correct?
Right, exactly. Right.
because it was June 4th of 1919 when Congress actually passed that amendment to the Constitution.
Right.
Why was Wisconsin the first of the states to ratify it? Is it because of our progressive roots?
No. It was actually not consistent with the recent history of Wisconsin at that point. As a matter of fact, 7 years earlier, there was a referendum for women to be granted the vote that was defeated 2-1.
2-1. Mm-hmm. What changed in those few years? My goodness. So, you know, as you think back to this shift in terms of how our government operates, how democracy operates, I'm struck by the violence and the volume of the protests that occurred. And I'm fast forwarding to what we saw during the Vietnam War, some of us who grew up during that period. And at the time, back in the mid-60s, late-60s, people around me were saying, the country has never been torn apart like this. There's never been any protest. And yet, when you look at history, in this case, looking at women getting the right to vote, actually, that's not true. There have been very violent protests around what this country would look like.
Right, beginning with the Revolution, right? The American Revolution and subsequent wars and the abolition fight and then obviously the Civil War and the struggle for the vote. And the 1930s was a period of significant protests with huge membership in the Communist Party because people thought that the capitalism was failing, and there have been so many periods of unrest and near uprising. But people don't know history. People don't know history, and you know, even immediately after the amendment was passed, where women got the vote, the next year the Equal Rights Amendment was introduced because there's still then and now there is nothing that constitutionally guarantees anyone against oppression based on sex, and so that was introduced the next year, and it failed to pass. It was reintroduced in the 1970s again. It didn't pass the sufficient number of states by the time of the congressionally mandated deadline, and it's been reintroduced again.
And still not passed. And we're going to talk about that in a moment, but I first want to remind our listeners that you are tuned to WUWM and you're listening to UWM Today. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio for this week's program is Carolyn Eichner. Carolyn is an associate professor of history and women's and gender studies at UWM's College of Letters and Science. And this is a bit of an anniversary show. This is the 100th anniversary, the year 100 years ago, from when women first got the right to vote here in the United States. And as Carolyn noted a moment ago, Wisconsin, the very first of the states to ratify the amendment. Carolyn, we were talking a moment ago about the Equal Rights Amendment and the fact that today, the fact that that amendment has not been approved and still remains very controversial suggests that although women can vote, they really haven't crossed the finish line in terms of getting the full protection that others, that men in particular, have had in our society for generations.
That's right. In the same way that in the 19th century there were women and men who recognized that there were all sorts of gender inequalities that weren't just about the vote, today we still have a significant gender pay gap. I think 24 of the Fortune 500 companies are headed by women. So that's, you know, 400 and whatever that is by men. Obviously, we've not had a woman president, vice president. These kinds of inequities remain in our society. And I think that oftentimes because there has been so much progress, people tend to not recognize the fact that these inequalities persist. And there are a number of things that where people feel like, well, that's just tradition, that's just the way it is. But one can say that about all sorts of oppressive things over history.
You wonder, is it your sense that maybe this is the time that you'll finally see that shift, that tilt over to give women more rights? And I'm thinking in part because of the Me Too movement over the last few years, where there's been this societal awakening of the harm that has been experienced by women as a result of sexual harassment.
Yes, I think now is a very particular time. I think that it has to do with the current presidential administration setting a certain tone and people reacting to that. And I think that has allowed a kind of a recognition of inequalities across the board. And so I think that the Me Too movement comes out of this kind of a context where people are just fed up, and that the voices coming together and together expressing the fact that this happened here. I mean, just the term Me Too. I mean, I literally remember the first day I saw this on social media with people saying Me Too and then making a comment. And I think that also the fact that we now have 100 women in Congress for the first time in history is a real reflection, again, of the current political climate and a need to address things. And so I think that the face of these Congress members, the fact that there are more women of color, that there are Muslim women, that we have a real kind of range of representatives that more closely reflects the American population. I think this is really a time of possible change, but that at the same time, historically, any time like this there's going to be a backlash, and the backlash is already sort of there, but people with privilege like to hold on to it.
Backlash and setbacks. I mean, if you are to take a look at the experience of the suffragist, before we went on and began taping a moment ago, we talked about the fact that from the first introduction of the concept of women getting the right to vote until that constitutional amendment finally being approved, it was more than 70 years.
That's right.
There were people who started the movement who were long, long gone before the victory finally came.
Yes, exactly. It was 72 years, and that's actually why the amendment was named the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, because Susan B. Anthony was one of the women who started the movement, and she didn't live long enough to see the vote attained. But yeah, it's 72 years is a lifetime.
How about today's college students? When you study this part of our history, when you talk about the rights that women didn't have for a long, long time, how does a young co-ed today react to what is history and perhaps in their mind something in the Wayback Machine?
A lot of students are really surprised and shocked by the difficult road that was taken to get to the point where women got the vote. And then also once we look at the contemporary culture, the contemporary economic, political, social situations, and they see the fact that there are still these inequalities, in many ways it opens their eyes and changes their understanding of the world. This is one of the beauties of education, because it's very easy to go along and think everything is fine if you have a certain amount of privilege and if you live in a certain part of the world, et cetera. But taking courses in women's and gender studies or history courses that engage questions of gender, really questions of gender also in race and class, which are always really tightly integrated in these courses, I think it really opens up their minds and it allows them to be better citizens, better participants in the society, and to better be able to articulate how they feel about things they see and read and hear.
And of course, it's not just women who take these classes.
Absolutely.
You have a lot of men in the Women's and Gender Studies program.
Absolutely. We do. Absolutely. So we have men and women. We have traditionally aged students, and we have returning students. And it's really the courses tend to be a pretty wonderfully diverse world. And I'm teaching Introduction to Women's and Gender Studies right now. And it's really it's a conversation with the students. I don't stand up there and lecture. I introduce topics. We discuss the readings. It's a class of 30, but they participate because they can often connect it to their own experience. And then we analyze it, and we are able to sort of break it down and put it in historical context in ways that is often it's informative and it's empowering.
I know it's really hard to generalize, but if you think of the men who have come through the women's studies programs, what sort of reaction have you seen them display?
I was meeting with a student the other day, a young man who said – he actually said that the course had changed his relationship with his girlfriend because he said he just hadn't realized some of the assumptions he was making about power. And I thought that that was a pretty wonderful thing. And for the young men, just like the young women, they understand – the political situation, economics, when they listen or read the news, they now have analytical tools to recognize, you know, what is gender? And also, how does that interact with other kinds of hierarchies of power, like race and like class, and questions of ability and disability, things that they hadn't thought about before. So I have, you know, young men and young women both tend to and older men and women who are in the course, they tend to react to it similarly, though obviously in certain ways for the young women, especially when we talk about things involving physicality and the body, questions of violence and power, they of course have a more kind of personal reaction.
Yeah. Are they hopeful? Are they hopeful of what might change in their lifetimes?
It's a mix. Sometimes students find it a little difficult emotionally even to recognize the level of struggle that has gone on and the level of struggle that goes on because we talk about – we don't just talk about the United States. We talk about it in global context. And when they recognize the kind of inequality and kinds of oppressions that are still going on here and around the world, it can be a bit overwhelming. And so part of studying and analyzing it is a way of grasping it. And you don't want to erase the emotional impact at all, but you want to be able to analyze it and critique it and then hopefully take some sorts of actions to – bring change.
And here you're teaching a class in one of America's most segregated cities. Race also has to be has to find itself in these conversations about equality.
Yeah, absolutely. In the classes I teach in history and in women's and gender studies, race is absolutely integrated into it because, I mean, obviously in American history, but in, you know, in global history, race has been a construction that has shaped who holds power and who is excluded from power, and whether it's in terms of slavery or colonialism or just mere segregation. I shouldn't say mere segregation, but segregation, you know, with, as you said, Milwaukee has quite a history of I think it's very important for students to understand that the power that is held in racial inequality, it has both historical and contemporary connections that shape our experience.
And that's where studying the history, looking back at the struggle, a 72-year struggle to see women get the vote can be instructive.
Yes, absolutely. And then when they look – until recently, many historians didn't recognize the racial split in the women's suffrage movement and the fact that Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, some of these other women were just really not willing to stand on the side of black men getting the vote. And so that's been a bit of a wake-up call. So it's important to analyze the whole picture and the whole context. But that kind of racial division is horrific. And it obviously shaped the 19th century and the 20th and the 21st.
So you mentioned black men. Were the suffragists back at the turn of the century, were they supportive of black women getting the vote?
Mostly, but there were certain points where the struggle seemed particularly dire, where some of the women's suffrage movement leaders were willing to consider just white women getting the vote. This was not central to their struggle, but it was considered by some. And there were black women in the suffrage movement. There were middle-class black women who were involved, but they were small minority and women like Ida B. Wells, who was a journalist and a suffragist and an activist against lynching specifically. She was in the aftermath of the Reconstruction period, after the Civil War, when control of the states went back to the South, when the United States government pulled out, the rise in incredible violence against African Americans was enormous, and
that was
lynching,
the backlash,
right? Exactly, and lynching was a method. It was a terrorism, really, used to control the black population. And Ida B. Wells wrote and published about this, and traveled, and she went to England and published about it to globally shame the United States, really, and that really raised awareness. And so, I mean, the reality is when women got the vote in 1920, it was really only white women who got the vote, because neither black men nor black women in the South really had an opportunity to vote until the 1960s with the Voting Rights Act.
You had the Jim Crow laws.
Exactly.
You had poll taxes. You had lots of ways to marginalize people of color who otherwise should have been in that voting booth.
Right, exactly. So they legally had the right to vote, but they did not have access to the vote.
Such irony, given the fact that the suffragist movement itself was based on the model of abolition, getting rid of slavery, and yet this conflict made it very difficult for some to see that black women also should have been included.
Exactly, and this is why it's so important to analyze not just questions of gender, but race and then class also, because again, you have all these working class women, these poor women, where the vote is like, okay, that's just lovely, but you know, how do we eat that? So to understand the situation, you have to really look at these different kinds of structures and the way that they intersect.
I asked if your students are hopeful looking ahead at perhaps someday seeing the Equal Rights Amendment approved, ratified. How about you?
I am somewhat hopeful. I mean, I think that the Equal Rights Amendment has so much attached to it in terms of – it's just a simple sentence about guaranteeing protection from discrimination based on sex. But I think that it's such a hot-button item that at least in the near future, I don't think there's much chance of it passing. Maybe in the next decade we'll see what happens, especially in 2 years. But I think that there's a real ebb and flow of progress. And you know, as I mentioned, the 100 women in the Congress, various – the Me Too movement – my students' level of awareness. A young woman came to me last week who wants to start an organization on campus that's just to talk about questions of gender. And she asked me to be the advisor. And so the fact that that's really, you know, rising, it's a grassroots kind of thing, those are very optimistic things.
Well, continue to be optimistic. Let's look forward to perhaps doing a show sometime in the not-too-distant future when we can talk about another ratification of an amendment.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you, Carolyn. Carolyn Eichner, Associate Professor of History and Women and Gender Studies, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.